good to go now. Just before we start, just a couple of changes in the membership. Cathy Hines from the PPN has resigned from the PPN, so that obviously means her resignation from the SPC, and the PPN will nominate a replacement for Cathy in the coming weeks. Kieran Leahy from the Dublin Chamber, again, Kieran has left his role in the Dublin Chamber, so again, a resignation from the SPC. His colleague, Mia Finnegan, is attending today just to observe, and she will be nominated by Dublin Chamber in the coming weeks to replace Kieran. So you're very welcome, Mia. I want to thank Cathy and Kieran for their work and wish them well in the future. And I'm sure all members agree with that. So with that, we'll move on to the
Chair,
first...
Chair, I think Siobhan is here from the PPN, aren't you?
Yeah, no, Siobhan has been here before. There's two. Cathy was the second member, but there will be a second nominee coming to work alongside Siobhan on the SBC from the BPM. Okay, we move on. Item one is the draft minutes of the meeting on the 16th of January. Can I get a proposer? Councillor Lacey and Councillor Bourne. Any matters arising from those minutes? No, take them as agreed. Item three is correspondence. It's mainly, well, it's all in relation to the transient visitor levy. And just to update members, you remember at the last meeting we spoke about nominating or setting up a working group between the four Dublin local authorities. We've had correspondence from South Dublin County Council confirming that they wish to proceed with the above working group, and they've also nominated two councillors to sit in the group. We haven't heard back from Dunleary Rathdown. They had their SPC meeting. I was talking to the chair of their SPC before the meeting, but we have issued a reminder just to get word back from that, and then we will proceed with that working group. Any questions, Councillor Lacey?
Yeah, Chair, I think one significant thing has changed since the last meeting, and that is the, well, maybe not since the last meeting, but in the last period, and that is that the so-called Task Force on the Future of Dublin has a recommended such a hotel levy. The government has said that they support the contents of the task force report, so I'll believe it when I see it. And I believe that we should, arising from this meeting, write to the Minister for Finance and the Minister for, yeah, the Minister for Finance in particular, urging them now to proceed with that commitment. But above all, I think we need to make the point that, unlike the local property tax, it is really important that the government doesn't steal, and I use that word deliberately, steal any income from the hotel tax or whatever it's going to be called, because it really is important to send out the message on every single possible occasion to the citizens of Dublin that, despite the lies told by government ministers, the government steals about 90% of the local property tax. We don't get it. They tell people we get it. They steal it. And they use it for their own particular purposes. And in my view, that message needs to be sent out, because nearly every day I now get an email. And I support local property tax, unlike yourself, Chair. I think it is an important income element. But the it is very difficult to persuade the citizens of Dublin when they write to you and say, we pay our local property tax and now and we expect to get a service. Because the government never admits to the fact that it steals it, and it does steal it from the people of Dublin and Dublin City Council in particular. So if we're going to have a hotel tax, and I think we should, we need to make sure that the government doesn't steal that as well. Thank you.
Councillor Stevens.
Yeah, just Seamus, just to endorse like what Councillor Lacey said, I think it's very important that property tax is ring-fenced, that any money brought into the Dublin City Council, and I think there was a commitment by, in fairness, the Dublin City Council that they would highlight and ring-fence money, that things we can do through extra money, through extra funding, and make sure that the constituents there, or the people who live in the area, know that this is what we did with the extra money that was brought in by that. And I think Dublin City Council have been very proactive in that, and I think it's a pathway forward to ensuring that people feel happy. I don't think people have a big issue about paying property tax, but they want to see what it's been put into, and it's not going into a black hole. Thank you.
Goes to central government at the moment.
Thanks, Councillor.
Looking forward to Fianna Fáil's support in this issue in September, Chair.
Councillor Stinson online.
Thanks, Chair. I agree with Councillor Lacey. We should certainly do something to put pressure on the government, and certainly to publicise the fact that most of the property tax that got in this city is stolen by the government. And I think he's put it in very strong terms, which I agree with. That's literally what it is, theft. I think, you know, we need to look at what we can do to put pressure on them and on the government parties who sit in this chamber to give us back the money that they're stealing from us. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. So our members agree we'll write to the Minister for Finance just progressing the transit visitor levy.
Yeah, Chair, I accept that the letter may not be as strong as my verbal commentary.
I might not use the exact words, Councillor Lacey, if you don't mind. Aidan?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And I'm just going to have to say, on the visitor levy, again, we need to recognise the fact that there is a consumption tax already on tourists. And this is frequently missed in our discussions to say that there's nothing that they contribute in terms of tax that's directly paid for. So it's not paid by hotels or whatever. So if you want to do it, you have to factor in the 13.5% VAT. And maybe it might be interesting to see whether or not the central government could actually give us an indication about how much the VAT is actually generated in the area, just to give an indication on that.
Thanks. Councillor Kenny.
Thank you, Chair. And I just wanted to jump in and just ask, and it's okay if this isn't the appropriate place to ask for it. I'm always open to constructive criticism slash advice as a newer councillor. While we're writing to ministers, is there any use of us writing to the Minister for Justice also? When CAB was first created, we were told that the money from that would be directly going back to our communities. Would it be worthwhile this particular committee, RSPC, querying that and following that up?
Yeah, yes, we can do that, yeah. If members are agreeable. Yeah, we'll do that, so. Yeah, thanks. Okay, we're going to move on to item four, members. We have a presentation on housing rent arrears. We have Clive Ahern and Frank Darcy here to give us an update. So we'll have a presentation and then there'll be some follow-up questions and answers.
Thanks very much, Chair, and to the members, and thank you for inviting myself and Clive Ahern. I'm Frank Darcy. I'm the Executive Manager and Director of Housing Operations in Dublin City Council, for people that don't know me. So we're delighted to be here to do a presentation. I was very interested that the Chair said that the presentation was on rent arrears. The actual presentation is on the generation of income in rent and the rent arrears and the entry arrears. So, listen, we've split the presentation down into four main areas. First of all, Chair, income generation. And in the last 5 years, you know, the income generated from rents of our stock is just short of €500 million, which is not insignificant. We have 26,347 tenancies in the organisation this morning, and Clive will go through the details in relation to that. The second then part, then, Chair, is exactly as you said to look at the arrears situation and the responses to dealing with those arrears and the various things that Clive and the rent section are doing in relation to that. You know, there's the carrot and there's the stick. I suppose the good thing is that in the last 5 years, Chair, you know, the arrears have stabilised. It's in the last 5 years, it's gone up by 2 million. We know it's still far too high, but it has stabilised. And you know, dealing with Victor and people in finance in relation to the management of the legacy debt that you know that we have that's very old. Then, and we've spoken about this, the third part of what we're talking about is the review of our rent scheme. It's been in operation since 1996, our rent scheme, with a number of tweaks and changes. But it's time where I think that we need to look at a complete revision of the rent scheme and what that would mean. And then, and you and I have spoken about this, Councillor, is the bridging of the gap between the expenditure on housing maintenance last year. Look, we spent 180 million on housing maintenance in all various forms, and the income that we generated, which even though it's gone up by considerable amount in the last 5 years to 110 million last year, there's still a massive gap between what we're spending and what we are generating in income. So I'm going to ask Clive to take us through the presentation, and I'll do a summary at the end, and then we'll take whatever questions. Thanks, Chair.
Good afternoon, members. My name is Clive O'Hearn. I'm a senior executive officer in housing operations. So I might just first slide there. So basically, we've seen a gradual increase in the number of live tenancies we've had over the last number of years, and we've seen a particular increase in rental revenue. So that's up from 92 million 5 years ago up to about 111 million for the end of 2024. So quite an increase. I'll give an update on rent arrears and just give some details on our improved escalation procedures. Then I'll talk about our enhanced analysis of rent accounts. And I suppose of particular interest to this SPC is we had a lot of old legacy debt sitting on there for people that had passed away or people that had abandoned the properties and that. So we've been doing a lot of tidying up on that we're quite happy about. And then lastly, I'll just touch on some recruitment that we're doing and also the regular engagement that we have with tenants just to always try and maintain them in their tenancies. So I suppose this is just a graph of our table just showing the increases in our live rent accounts or in our live tenancies. So you can see it was about 25,000 in 2021 and it's gone up to 26,500 at the moment. So at the moment, we're currently housing 69,000 occupants in our properties. One piece of clarification just to say, this is just in respect of our own council properties. So it doesn't include RAS, it doesn't include long-term leasing, it doesn't include HAP, and it doesn't include any of the AHB properties either. So as you can see there, we've got about 69,000 occupants, and looking at an approximate population of the city of around 600,000. So it gives you a little bit of an indication there. Then just to give people a flavour, our average weekly differential rent charge. So naturally, there'll be people on higher and lower, but just to give people a feel for it, is €83. And then if you look at it on a monthly rate, it's 360. So that's what that is. And it sort of probably stands out in comparison to what some other rents would be. Then this is probably one of the most important slides, I think, today. You can see that back in 2020, we're bringing in 92 million, and then it goes 92 again, then it goes 95, then it goes 98, and then it jumps up effectively by about 12 million. So that's a huge increase and really significant. And I know Frank's going to allude later on in the presentation to the importance of the rental income that we bring in and how that funds the really important services that we have in housing maintenance. But I suppose I really want to sort of speak to that, because if you look at that over a five-year period, it's basically jumped by about 18 million. And in the year just gone by, it's gone up by 12. So really significant. We're really proud of that. And some items that we're responsible, some of them are external to us. So as you can see there, it might be a little bit small for some people, but just some of the bullets. I wanted to try and get the detail down so people could see. So increased social welfare payments. We have a number of our tenants and occupants who would be on social welfare, so naturally when that goes up and you have an income-based rent scheme, then naturally the amount of money being generated comes in higher. Naturally, I suppose, in a tight labour market, we've got increased employment earnings, and naturally that will feed through into the rent that we'll get from the tenants and occupants that we have within our properties. One thing to flag is that in the financial year in 2024, we've got 53 weeks instead of the usual 52. Yeah. So that's going to generate about an extra 2 million that you won't ordinarily see and that you would be unlikely to see in any of the immediate years after 2024. The increased number of tenancies, which I just had in the previous slide. So naturally, the more tenancies we have, the more income coming in, and the more total income coming in as well. I suppose one of the pieces that we're particularly proud of is our timely rent assessments. So if it takes us too long to do a rent assessment, then we've effectively missed capturing that income. But if we do it very quickly, it captures when the tenant or the occupants get additional earnings. We do a quick rent assessment. It means that's reflected in their weekly rent, and it all, I suppose, supports us as a council in generating that additional income. And then one of the things that we found particularly useful is we have access to the, it's a bit of a mouthful, but the local authority verification application, but it allows us to see changes in people's, particularly in people's social welfare. So it's a feed coming in from the DSP, and it allows us to see in real time. So we're not actually having to wait for tenants to tell us what the changes in earnings are. We can see that, not necessarily in real time, but quite close. And that's really been useful for us in getting through rent assessments quickly and timely, and having the most amount of income that we can. So I suppose the next one then is rent arrears. So just the net rent arrears, you can see 2020, they're 33. For 2025 and 2024, they're effectively the same thing. They're at 35 million. This is something that we're constantly trying to put downward pressure on. It is a challenging area. There is legacy debt there. I know that's something Frank might touch on later on. But just to sort of break it down, I think the table that's beside it is particularly useful. So you can see there's about 5,000 accounts there that the arrears are between 2 and above 19. And they're the particular focus of our energies in rent recovery. Now, even within that 5,000, so first of all, it's 20% of our overall tenancies. In fact, it's less than that. And even within that group, a number of them will be in rescheduling agreements. So just to say what a rescheduling agreement is that if you have the tenant and the occupants and they're in the arrears, and say for argument's sake, they're paying us €60 in weekly rent. If they're in a rescheduling agreement, they might be paying that rent and an additional piece each week, so it could be 10 or 15 on top of that. And therefore, it's performing arrears, and they're reducing the amount of arrears that they have with us. So that's the particular focus that we would have as a division in trying to reduce those and get each of them into the lower bands, and hopefully into a position where there's none.
70%.
Yeah. This is a particular breakdown of our rent accounts and the different categories they fall into. So 70% of our tenants are compliant. So that means, they're compliant. And basically the action that we have is we continue to monitor the accounts, and if everything's fine, that's grand. And if not, we always try and intervene early. And the remainder is then split between two groups. So one, I talked about it earlier, rescheduling agreements. So they're performing, we monitor them and we intervene early if there's any issues. But as you can see there, we're always trying to afford as many opportunities to our tenants to stay within the agreements and to work with them. And we work very closely with them and are always very conscious of the individual circumstances that our tenants can have, and just try to always, keep them within the agreements and keep them within the tenancy. The next group is irregular payments. This is probably the most challenging piece of it. And I suppose one of the things is where we have tenants that repeatedly won't engage with us and they won't pay, then it can turn more into a legal process, and there's legislation that we can carry out where needed. And then just lastly, it's the executive housing officers. So they're effectively, they're our rents team that's out in the ground. So, they're constantly engaging with tenants, whether it's, over the phone or on post, through the post, but generally actually calling to their houses and trying to, work with tenants and be aware of their individual circumstances and just, you know, try and keep the rent account on top of it and try and work with them and, as I say, stay within agreement. So that's a really important facility that we have, and they provide a really valuable service. So then, just the rent arrears recovery. So we're monitoring all of our accounts. Where any issues happen, there's early intervention when payments are missed. We're constantly trying to get people back into rescheduling agreements. We're escalating the arrears recovery process if all other options fail. And just to say, we'd be giving people multiple different opportunities and working with them. So it's not like it just jumps very fast. We work with them and try and engage with them. But at times, as I say, where there's repeated failure to pay and to engage, then it does go up the escalation process. And then just lastly, we're promoting early engagement between our tenants and the EHOs just to try and support retention of the tenancy. And there's just a flavour for like the multi-layered nature of the process. So, you know, they're missing a few payments, there's a warning one, then there's a warning two, then there's a warning three, and you're starting to get into the legal element of it. Then there's a statutory tenancy warning. There's the option for a review there if there's merit and the tenant, you know, opposes it and there's some grounds for that it doesn't stand. And then you're getting into district court proceedings. And just to say, once you're even getting into our district court proceedings, there'll be multiple opportunities where the tenant will be aware of this. So they'll be written out to them saying that we're going to take this to court. Then we'll be writing out to them again when we get a court date. Then when we get a court date, there's often multiple adjournments. And then eventually we'll get a possession order. And again, we'll be writing out to them saying to them we have a possession. So it really is very multi-layered. And then just below that, there's prevented, remedial and legal, but we're always trying to really, the focus of our energies is always on the first one, preventative, because nobody really wins when you're getting into the legal process. You know, that's what we really try and avoid. So we really try and stop it early on in the process where we can. So then I talked about this a little bit at the start, just trying to, you know, undertake a robust analysis of our rent accounts to ensure like that we've good oversight and that our accounts reflect the state that we have. So we've spent a lot of time in about the last 6 months, and something that we're really proud of, going through old rent accounts where, as I said, they shouldn't have been on the books, and we've gone and cleared them. They were for where people had abandoned the property, properties had been repossessed, people had passed away, people had left for various other reasons. So that was a good bit of tidying up that we did. Again, we're looking at live rent accounts where there's sudden changes. So somebody regularly pays us, and then suddenly it drops off. And this is something that we've started to, you know, finesse that and liaise closely with our area offices and allocations, just in the sense that where we would see that, engaging with them as to ascertain why has that suddenly stopped. Is there a welfare issue? What's the case? And that's something, again, that has worked really successfully. I spoke earlier about the EHOs. They are sort of boots on the ground. They're really useful. They give you that direct human contact with our tenants and with the occupants. And so we're going to be doing some additional recruitment in that area, I would say, in the next sort of 4 to 6 weeks. Our EHOs maintain that strong communication with our tenants. And as I said there, they facilitate just all different channels for keeping things open with our tenants.
Okay, I'll take the last one.
And I'll just hand over to Frank. Thank you.
Thanks, Clive. So this is the last slide, Chair. And, you know, we're talking about a proposed review of the rent scheme. And I spoke earlier about the funding of the maintenance deficit, you know, the income even this year being 110 as against, you know, our outgoings of 180. The differential rent increase and, you know, what that would mean. Our differential rent is 15%. You know, I suppose I selected Clare, Cork and Galway because they're all greater than ours. But we want people living in high-quality homes. We know that maintenance costs are expensive. We know that we probably need to look at secondary earners. You know, perhaps look at, you know, what can an increase in differential rent do for us, and we can red circle that. And I know, Chair, that you're proposing, you know, a joint subcommittee of the two strategic policy committees, finance and housing, to look at this and to guide us forward in that way. So that's it. And we'll take questions. Thanks.
Thanks, Frank and Clive. I'm going to open it up to the floor to any questions. Online, Councillor Kenny.
Gairmila Margos, and thank you so much for the presentation. I just have two questions. So the first question that I have is surrounding the debts there. So I think it was 204 tenancies or 284 tenancies are €19,000 plus in debt with their rent. And that's understandable, of course. So the question that I have is, say, for example, that person passes away. Your debt, when you die, your debt dies, which is there a different circumstance or a different kind of procedure there for collecting then the 19,000 plus that's due even when that person passes on? Or what is the procedure surrounding that? And then I just wanted to ask as well, around the money that we're spending on maintenance for properties, is there any direct correlation between these or a breakdown that we could get of them being part fives that we required? And how many of them would be like extremely old flat complexes? Are we just putting a band-aid there over something that like really just needs a deep retrofit? But that's all for me. And thank you so much for the presentation. I really appreciate it. It was good to get that insight.
Yeah, thanks. I'm going to take a couple if that's okay. Councillor Barron.
Thanks, Chair, for that. And thanks for the report. Just a few things I just want to run through there. Of the 234 tenants that are over 19k in arrears, how many of them are non-committal? Are they non-engaging? So have we done a breakdown of that 234 just to see where they are? You know, it, you see there's been a jump as well in evictions for last year, for 21 last year. I presume they are some of the people that we've spoke previously about. And again, I know the LAVA system that was brought in around 2019, I think we can see the data now. It's a lot better. You can correlate the data. You can see a lot more there as well too. And then just secondly, just on the differential rents, I just see a benchmark, Clare, Cork, Galway. What are the three other local authorities' differential rent rates currently at? I'd like to see them and maybe to do a charter of all every local authority in the country. I'd actually like to see a full table of every single of the 32 or 33 local authorities across the country. I would like to see the benchmark or the table of where we are in that listing for our 15%. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, Councillor Pidgeon. Sorry, Michael, we're not hearing you here in the chamber.
You're muted, Michael.
Sorry, my mic reset. Ahead. Can you hear me now?
Yeah,
sorry about that. My question was just about the two groups you identified towards the end of the presentation of people in arrears. Is it right to very roughly think that people in rescheduling agreements are people whose income has changed and that's kind of the source of the arrears, if you know what I mean? And then those in irregular payments are those who are simply not paying rent? Because I understand for some people, like it just seems like there's a big difference between someone who maybe hasn't declared an income or has a dispute about their income or something like that versus people who just aren't paying at all. So I just trying to understand like what kind of proportions we're talking about, like how many, because arrears sometimes conjures up an image of people just not paying at all. And I don't think that's obviously not what most people are doing, I suspect. But is there any sense of kind of proportion between those two groups? Thank you.
Thanks, Councillor Steenson.
Thanks, Chair. Much of what I was going to say has already been covered by the other councillors who spoke, but I find it incredible that unless it's a wage, a salary not being declared, that somebody would end up owing over 19,000 in rent. And you also mentioned that, you know, where people die or just abandon the property. It seems incredible to me because I know, and I'm sure all the councillors will agree with me, as soon as somebody dies, they're not even buried and there's somebody onto you looking for their place. So how is it that the council isn't proactive in dealing with those vacant properties immediately and seeing what the situation is? And just on the funding of maintenance and the deficit there, 110 million to 180. I know we've touched before, not this committee, but in the council itself, on the money owed by the state to the council. I know it's not your department, for the ambulance service. That, to me, would nearly cover, I think that's 60 odd million would cover that deficit there. Again, comes back to what Councillor Lacey was saying. The state keeps just robbing money off us. And, you know, we need to get that money in and get these things done. Thank you, Chairman.
Thanks. I'm going to ask the two lads to come back on those, and then I'm going to take questions from the Chamber. Sorry, Councillor Kenny, do you want to come back in briefly?
Just really, really quickly. Sorry, there was one point that I missed there that I wanted to speak on. Obviously, the rent section does absolutely fabulous work and, you know, fair dues to us. But I've had a considerable amount of constituents come to me and say, the council are telling me that I am $4,000 or $5,000 in arrears because Exabody is like down on my floor. And then they're going to the rents department and they could have a protection order against the person that's technically down on the floor. And that protection order, say, is from 2021 and it's 2025 and they're still being charged the rent for them. And the rent section is coming back to them and saying, we actually can't take that person off your floor until that person is there beside you. But they can perform that duty because they have a protection order against them. So if there's anything there on that, I'd really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. Clive and Frank to come back in.
Thanks very much, Chair. I'm actually going to take Councillor Kenny's one first, and then I'll ask Clive to come in on the detail. Look, in relation to that specific instance that you raised, if you make contact with me directly, we'll go through and we'll find out exactly where you know what the issues are in that particular, and we'll deal with that. And just on the matter raised by Councillor Steenson in relation to you know, properties where people have died, it's not about the actual reallocating the property. It's actually about us tidying up and ensuring that, you know, those are not carried as arrears, and Clive's been doing an exercise on that, so we were making reference to that. Pass over to you now, Clive.
Perfect. Thank you, Frank. So, yeah, Councillor Kelly and Councillor Steenson asked quite similar questions. So just to say, when somebody passes away, we don't, as a council, pursue the estate for those arrears, and therefore those arrears are written off. So there's no chasing. When the person dies, the arrears goes. So as Frank says, the vacancy, I suppose, is a separate issue. But just from our point of view, if the person dies, then it's written off. Councillor Barron, you were asking about the engagement with the 234 people. The vast majority of those 234 people will most likely be within the legal process. So they'll already have either been over in court and will have got adjournments, or will have been in court and will have brought them into a rescheduling agreement. So we'll have dealt with all of those. They'll already be effectively in a focus, and we'll be dealing with them in particular different engagements. The differentiation of the rents, yeah, what you call it, we already have a table done of all the different local authorities in Ireland, so we're happy to provide that. Just one thing to say about the 15% and 16 and 17, that's just one headline figure of how a rent scheme works. There'll be lots of different elements to it. So if you look, some income will be included in some councils, other income won't. How you deal with secondary earners will be one issue, a cap on secondary earners. How you deal with self-employed people will be another issue, maximum rents. So there's loads of different levers when it comes to it. And I suppose the 15% or the charge that you'll put on the principal economic earner, the person who's earning the highest amount in the household, that's where you'll generate the vast majority of your money. But there are lots of different elements. And I suppose in looking at any different scheme, you'd effectively have to get down into the details to get the full holistic view of how one of the schemes work. Just Councillor Pidgeon, you were talking about the rescheduling agreements and how people get into arrears. I suppose there's multiple different ways that people get into arrears, and you're right. A lot of times a sudden change in income, usually, in fact, a good news for the tenant or the occupant, where they've been on a particular income and then suddenly they get quite a jump up in their income. But the person in their head might have almost habitually got used to just paying this set amount of rent. And then you can just get that dichotomy where the person in their head continues to pay effectively the old rate of rent, and that's where the arrears can start to go up and go up. And there's lots of different, I suppose, personal circumstances, and we'd often be charting, we'd like be able to see the rent statement for all of that, and we'd also have we'd have notes for the tenant, and you can often see there's parallels, but there's no, when we look at all the different cases, there's no sort of one set rule for what generates it. There's lots of different individual circumstances, and I suppose for us, as I was mentioning in the presentation, it's about trying to maintain that personal link with them and trying to get them back into some form of payment, depending on where, if there's no payment, to get them into some payment. If there's some payment, trying to get them back into covering their rent, their weekly rent. If they're paying their weekly rent, trying to get them back into paying their weekly rent and some amount off the arrears. But yeah, there's multiple different cases within it. And then I had already touched on Councillor Steenson's question about the write-off of people who passed away.
Okay, thanks. In the chamber, Councillor Bourne.
Thanks, Chair. I'm glad to see the issue of rent arrears being tackled. When I first joined this council in 2019, I was astounded at the runaway figures of rent arrears, and there didn't seem to be any urgency about it. So I'm glad to see that now being tackled. In relation to the rent differential, how about it would be tied to inflation, such as private rents are tied to inflation, or they can be. Rents can be put up at the amount of inflation. That could be an idea there. Sorry, I had something else to say as well. It's gone. Thanks a million.
Thanks. Councillor Lacey.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. It's not often I defend government, but just with reference to Councillor Steenson's point, it's not the government who's stealing this. This money has been withheld from us by our own tenants, whether for good reasons or bad reasons, but it's they who are withholding us, not government. To put it in context, I grew up in a council home. My parents were tenants until, I don't know, early teens. And I always remember the rent was always there. The blue small rent receipt was always received because paying the rent was an absolute priority for my parents, and I think it is for an awful lot of people. And, you know, we aren't been having a laugh at, not by the vast majority of tenants, but the notion that, what's the figure, that over 700 people owe more than 19,000. That's outrageous. I mean, even if that was halved, that's a couple of years' rent for an average rent. The average rent is 500 a month. That's people refusing to pay, not able to pay, but refusing to pay. And I think we have to take this seriously. On behalf of the 70% of tenants who do pay and who do go out to work and earn a living and make their contributions and then rightfully seek maintenance services from the council. So we owe it to the 70% to tackle the people who don't pay. And of course, if people can't pay, we need to deal with that. But to a large extent, the differential rent scheme provides for that, you know, bearing in mind individual circumstances. So, I mean, I really do believe that people are having a laugh. I want to ask just three quick questions. One is just the attitude of the courts to people who don't pay. I have to tell you, day by day, week by week, my faith in the Irish courts and judges gets less and less, not just on this, but on antisocial behaviour and all sorts of things. I think some of the judges at district court level think they're in the Supreme Court and make, you know, very ponderous judgments. We have people refusing to pay, and I suspect they are not really being taken seriously, and we're not being taken seriously. The second is the issue of agreement that we were to have and which was provided for in law for the Department of Social Welfare to deduct payments directly. I believe that actually the biggest beneficiaries of that are actually social welfare recipients, because if you don't have a lot of money and you get money, you spend it. And rents are probably the last thing on their list. So direct deduction, I think, is something that we should be pursuing with the department. And the last point is just, how do we deal with new tenants? Are they obliged to go on direct debit or standing order from the beginning? And if they're not, I think we should try and do it. I think our approach should be to help people out of debt. If you have a debt of 20,000, it's impossible to pay it back. If you have a debt of 500, you can do it. And I think we need to stop people getting to that level where they owe absolutely impossible sums of money for an average, ordinary person to pay back. But, you know, 19,000 owed by 700 people, that's crazy. But thanks for the work. I mean, I understand it's difficult. I understand the work you're doing. But as I said, I believe we owe it to the 70% of people who are paying. Thank you.
Thanks, Councillor Stevens.
Yeah, for some reason I seem to be agreeing with Councillor Lacey a lot today, but I think there is an approach that we should look at maybe, in that we should incentivise people, maybe write off some of their debt, but try and get them back into some, making some form of payment. Sometimes people get into this groove that maybe rent is way down the pecking list as regards payment, but maybe we have to educate them a little bit more and try and incentivise them into a situation that either take their payments out through Sorcerer, through their welfare or whatever, but encourage them to try and pay back some of the debt, and we will work with you, write off some of the debt and get them back into the mode of paying their debt, their repayments either on a monthly or a weekly basis. Thank you.
Thanks. Just a couple of comments myself. I just want to acknowledge, as we've said, that there's a lot of work's been done in this last few years, because it was getting out of control, but it seems to have plateaued now. So we're talking about the arrears. Can I just clarify in my own head, just the increase in tenancy and obviously the increase in income has resulted in an extra 12 million, but the cost of that is about an increase in about 70 million from 110 to 180. Can maybe just get more details on that, or am I reading that correctly? Councillor Lacey's question about deduction at source, I just endorse that, and just for an update on that. And then just on succession of tenancies, where someone in a house succeeds the tenancy, do they succeed the debt, or is the debt cancelled when the main tenant ends? Just if you can just elaborate on that. Councillor Steenson, are you looking to come back in briefly?
Yeah, just 2 points. Like Councillor Stevens, it's strange to find myself agreeing with Councillor Lacey. But just to clarify for Councillor Lacey, the money I was referring to being stolen by the government was the money that they owe us for the ambulance service, not the money that the tenants owe. But I find it odd that when somebody dies, the arrears are written off. That almost implies that anybody who owes rent has no money. I mean, surely they should at least check to see, did that person have any money and can they pay it off? If they don't, they don't. But if there is money there, and you know, a huge amount of tenants would have some income and
something to look at,
assets at the end of the day. And also just in relation to the councillor, I'm not sure who it was, but in relation to barring and orders and all of that, tenants would need to strictly get permission of the court before they release any of those documents or even discuss that, which are in-camera proceedings with either even a councillor or the city council. So just to bear that in mind.
Great, thanks. I'm going to allow Councillor Kenny and Councillor Barron in very briefly. Councillor Kenny.
Sorry, I'm just going to ask Frank and the department just a request if we could receive it. I'd really appreciate it. The 234 tenancies that are over 19 grand in debt, can we please receive a breakdown on how long this is owed by how many tenancies? So, for example, if 100 of them owe it over 5 years, or this debt has like accumulated over 5 years, does that make sense?
Yeah,
I just really appreciate to see the breakdown of that, if you don't mind. Thank you so much.
Councillor Barron.
Thanks, Seamus. I'll just be brief. Just to get the figures, Clive or Frank, just from three other local authorities in Dublin on the differential rates. And just to advise, what was the year? I believe it was somewhere in the mid-90s. We haven't reset the rate since for differential rate. Just so for that it's the committee is aware of that date as well too. And just of the 21 evicted last year, are we still chasing up in relation to the arrears on that, or is that very similar to when people die? Does that arrears is annulled? Are them 21 people still being chased for them arrears on that figure? I'd love to know on that. Thank you very much, James.
Okay, thanks. I'll go back to Frank and Clive.
Thanks very much, Chair. So I'm going to kind of take a few of them, and then Clive is going to come back in with more of the answers. So, yeah, Councillor Byrne, yeah, I suppose we are making progress in relation to arrears. I don't think this stabilises, it's plateaued, as the Chairman said. It's about reducing it now. There's probably a rump of debt there, and myself and Victor have had a few meetings in relation to that, and where we go with debt that's probably irrecoverable, to be truthful. In relation to Councillor Kenny at the end, the 234, yeah, we'll get that breakdown for you. I couldn't agree with you more, Councillor Lacey, in relation to the duty of care. I keep saying that to Clive and all the team, the duty of care that we as public servants have to the 70% who are compliant and who pay their rent on a timely, up-to-date basis. I'll let Clive talk to you about the attitudes of the court. I think it's fair to say, because Clive goes over to the court, is that, getting a repossession order is extremely onerous for any local authority. It's very onerous for us. They go through everything with a fine-tooth comb. But I'll let Clive come back in. Yeah, I agree entirely in relation to new tenancies and early engagement at small amounts so that we try and encourage good practice. And Clive will talk to deduction of source. I think that's me, Clive.
Perfect. Just Councillor Lacey on the various different ones. I'd regularly go over to court myself. Like, there is a high bar, and it always needs to be for them to give us a possession order, because it is quite a significant thing to be allowed to repossess the home that somebody's living in. But where we get the relevant materials, the courts do, they look on the different, the details of the case, and we work well with them. And, it's quite a difficult one. So, as I say, we need to make sure that we have all of our ducks in a row in order for us to get a possession order. But we work closely with the courts and with our own law department. Just on the deduction at source, I think you're dead right. That's something that we would look positively, but it would need, it would be something we'd have to do in conjunction with the department. I'd say you might need to have a rent scheme for the country, as opposed to having one based on each individual local authority, if we were ever going to get there. That's something I'd say most local authorities would probably look favourably on. If that was the carrot at the end of it, that you go and get one rent scheme that happens across the country, but that it's deducted at source. So, as I say, that would be something that would need to be done with the department. Yeah.
The law has been passed a couple of years now. It just hasn't been commenced. Can we ask the right to the new minister asking that that provision would be enacted or implemented, whatever the correct legal word is?
Yeah, we can do that if members are agreeable. Yeah, agreed. Okay, Clive.
And then just further, Councillor Lacey, you're dead right. When we get new tenancies, we'd sign them up to a direct debit or to a household budget. Household budget is when somebody goes on post to collect their social welfare, and it's deducted straight away. So that's something that we find particularly useful. In relation to Councillor Stevens and the write-off of debt and taking it out at source, I suppose that's a similar issue. We would agree with you. That's something that definitely, where it's taken out at source, I suppose, for a number of our tenants, I think that would work for them, and it would certainly work for us. So that's something that we would see as positive. Chair, you were asking about the succession of debt. So I suppose where somebody has died and they were the tenant and somebody else is succeeding them, again, effectively the debt dies with the person who owed the arrears. So it doesn't succeed to who else has taken over the property.
What if it's not a debt? What if the subtenant just takes over the tenancy?
Well, the arrears are always linked to the tenant. So in the sense that, say, if you have one tenant and they might have, for instance, a child or a niece or anything like that, the arrears are still, from a legal point of view, the arrears are linked to the tenant. They're not linked to the occupants. So then when the primary tenant goes and passes away or whatever happens, those arrears are written off because we couldn't, the courts wouldn't allow us to try and link it otherwise. Councillor Steenson was talking about pursuing debt when there has been a death of a tenant, and that's certainly something that we're happy to look at. And then just the breakdown, Councillor Kenny was asking the breakdown of that 234 by length of period. That's perfectly fine. That's something that we'll do. But just to say, like, we really pursue those. People should just, previously we went and had, just for people's information, back in 2012, there used to be a position where we would, as a local authority, be able to almost issue a notice to quit, it was called, ourselves. And that was eventually taken to the courts and was seen as being repugnant to the Constitution. Then there's new legislation was passed in 2014, the Housing Miscellaneous Provisions Act. That was commenced a year later, and that has worked its way through the system. But we really pursue those, particularly those 234 people And where the courts will give us a possession order, then we will take that further. But equally, where people are in a rescheduling agreement and the arrears are performing, then that's something that we'll naturally work with. That's the position we want to get people in. For various reasons over a period of time, people, you know, debt has accumulated. But where people are working down that debt, that's something that we see that is a positive, and you know, we work with those people in that situation. Councillor Barron was asking about the differential rents for the three other local authorities, and that's certainly something we can provide. That's no problem. And then just in respect of our current scheme, so our current scheme is really based from around the late 1990s, so 93, 94, and then again in 96. There have been a number of tweaks, the last one made in 2019, but the body of the scheme was done in the late 1990s. And then just arrears of repossessions. That's an interesting one. When we repossess a property, the arrears are generally written off, but if those arrears stay on account, they can affect the ex-tenant's ability to access housing services from ourselves. So we will see some of our tenants where we have repossessed the property off them, they will maintain a rent card and they may continue to pay down that debt because it facilitates them getting back in and getting access to housing services from ourselves.
That's a good question. What happens when the principal earner is different to the primary tenant, and the primary tenant, the tenant, dies, but the principal earner upon which the new rent is then assessed is still alive and living in the flat? Where stands the debt in that sort of situation?
So I suppose first thing to say, so we're the rent scheme. You know, when everybody's there in the property, we go and base the primary, you know, the principal economic earner is what we do the 15% off.
Yeah.
When that person then dies, then you get
Principal earner stays alive.
Exactly, when the tenant dies, I'm with you. When the tenant dies and the principal economic earner, then you get into a succession element. And I suppose for us, that's one of those ones where to try and, like, formalise that succession as quickly as possible is key, because the arrears are linked to the tenant. So I know what you're getting at. The main driver of the rental income coming into that property is the principal economic earner, and the arrears aren't linked to them. But that's where we try to get that as tight a period for the succession to happen. And I suppose from that person, they want to succeed to, in most cases, want to succeed to the property. So they'll be usually sort of compliant in that process in order to, you know, become the succeeding tenant into that, and then we can go and hit all arrears, or hopefully there's no arrears, hopefully the person just takes on and continues to pay.
Okay, thank you.
Just to finish up, Chair, some information, and I think Councillor Lacey referred to it. Look, we're not about sort of going after people who are not able to pay. There's a fantastic engagement between the rents and the team down there to assist people as much as possible. We are, however, sort of going after people who won't pay. And it's interesting, like, you see the numbers in relation to repossessions last year that Clive's driven through. You know, but there have been situations where, you know, we've got the order from court and we've gone to execute that order, which is our duty. And last year we recovered €200,000 from people who had arrears, who were able to pay off those arrears in total so that they could secure their homes. So, look, it's a constant work in progress in relation to dealing with arrears and repossessions, and I commend the team for the work that they're doing.
Yeah, thanks, Frank, and thanks, Clive, for the presentation. Thanks, members, for their questions. As Frank mentioned there and has been discussed before, I'm proposing that we establish a joint working group with the Housing SBCA and ourselves, just to review rents, because it has been such a long time since we've had a rent review. So a member is agreeable, and if so, we will do the formal part of forming that group and seeking nominations. Are members agreeable?
Okay. Okay,
thanks very much. Okay, next item, members, is item 5. It's a presentation on the rates legislation, and Enda's going to bring us through the presentation.
Good afternoon, everyone. Enda Kerr, Head of Management Accounting, and I'm just going to give you an overview of the Local Government Rates and Other Matters Act 2019. Just the background to the Act. I think we're off now. Okay, so just I'm going to give you a background on the Act. So first of all, just maybe look at it nationally. Commercial rates accounts for income of 1.8 billion in the local government sector for 31 local authorities. For ourselves in DCC, at 2025 level, our rates income is 412 million euro, and that's about 28% of the DCC overall revenue budget. In terms of the rates legislation, there was about 20 separate different pieces of legislation over the years that governed the operation of rates, and a lot of that actually legislation also predated the Constitution of 1937. So the Department of Housing, along with a rates working group, undertook a review to modernise the legislation into one overall piece. So the legislation was enacted on July 2019. It's the Local Government Rates and Other Matters Act. Other matters refers to things like the residential tenancies and also the Planning Act, so there's no impact on rates legislation. So just for this presentation, I'm going to focus primarily on two main areas, which is Section 9 is the abatement of rates, or the old vacancy refund. Section 15 is the waiver of rates, and then there's other sections within the Act. So the first section here is looking at Section 19, the abatement of rates. This allows for the provision of abatement of rates in respect of vacant properties. And that says that a local authority may make a provision for a temporary abatement of vacant properties. And then it's subject to a maximum relief set by the minister. It may be made, say, in respect of classes of liable persons. So the liable person is the occupier of the relevant property on the 1st of January. Or if the relevant property is vacant, it would be the person who at the time is entitled to access that property. As part of this abatement of rates, you have to undertake a public consultation. And just important to bear in mind that it also is a reserve function of our elected members to adopt this rates abatement. Just in this situation with Dublin City Council, the rates abatement in DCC is set at zero. So that means if you have a vacant property, you pay 100% of the rates liability. So that means that all vacant properties in DCC pay their rates in full. This has been effective, the effective rate since budget 2023. So this is the third year where the rate has been set at zero. If we bring this back in, this would be a cost to the city, because what we're doing is we're providing for the full liability of the charge, and then we're providing for a right. So that would be a cost to the city. In recent years, we've intruded this position as part of our budget strategy reform as part of the local property tax, and that comes to council in September, October every year, and that's a key component of the annual revenue budget strategy. And again, what we do is, as with last year, we get this position adopted at the annual statutory budget meeting, which is in November of each year. As part of the public consultation that lasts for 14 days, we have to produce a written report of the public consultation, giving the members an overview of what was decided and what was the impacts. And that was brought to the November 2024 council meeting. In respect then of Section 15, this is a scheme for the waiver of rates. And what this says here is that a local authority may introduce a rates alleviation scheme to support national and local policy objectives, things that will be included, say, in the National Spatial Strategy, your development plan for your area, your local area plan, and local economic community plans. Just in terms of the overall process, what happened was the regulations around Section 15 issued by the Department, Minister Alan Dillon, in July of 2024. And what that had called was the Finance SPC was to consider all proposals, or if you didn't have a Finance SPC, a relevant SPC. What was happening then was they were to endorse or reject any proposals before the 30th of June. The SPC can then only propose one scheme, And then that one scheme then goes to a public consultation and must run for 14 days. What happens then is that the this waiver scheme, it would be a it's a reserve function, so that means our elected members adopt that. We would propose that that meeting will be held at the statutory budget meeting. And when you're doing this proposed waiver, there has to be an assessment of the financial impact for the council, the impact on the ratepayer, the impact on revenue income. As I said earlier on, you know, rates income €412 million, about 28% of our total revenue budget. And then also maybe to include maybe any other relevant information. I suppose just in case then, just for considerations then for Dublin City Council, would be that the timelines to develop the scheme, that if we're bringing in a scheme, there may be an impact on the software changes to our IT systems and turning the organisation to accommodate this. The financial loss of rates income. This, in recent years, we've done, maybe say, remember last year we did the increased cost of business grant, we did the power-up grant. During COVID, we had the COVID waivers, we had start-up grants, things like that. All those grants were fully funded by the government, be it the Department of Housing for the COVID waivers, or the last year with ICOP power-up, that was fully funded by the Department of Enterprise, Trade and Employment. So that means in this case, we would have to fund this ourselves. So there's a financial loss to this. There's an impact. There's a budget implication. That means we have to find this additional funding to fund this scheme. So that would have a direct impact on services. And I suppose when we look at our budget in recent years, the budget kind of has become increasingly challenging year on year. We have the revenue budget is about €1.5 billion, so it is we are quite a large organisation. But within that, our funding streams are quite constrained to what we can and can't do. So in recent times, we've had increased cost of pay deals, we have energy and inflation. We see maybe impact from increased cost through tenders, through engagement with contractors, the cost of provision of their services has gone up. And that all puts a pressure on the funding of the city. So we're looking, working with kind of say quite limited and scarce resources. Another maybe thing to consider as well is with the waiver is that you might need to look at, you know, if you're doing it with your ratepayers, is that ratepayers maybe that are in good financial standing, that they're not in arrears on their accounts, they've got a good payment record, they're in a payment plan, that it shouldn't be an idea that maybe people would be getting this regardless of how they've engaged with the council in the past. Just rough brief look then just at the other section. Section 4 was the rates to be levied on the occupier. What's happening, one thing here would be we now do one moiety a year. It used to be January and July, now it's issued in January. The bill goes out in one time. This has been quite successful for us in the rates office. In the last 12 months, we've increased our direct debit payments from initially say we were maybe at about maybe say just over 5,200 a month paper direct debit. Now as of March 25 we've got just over 6,000. So in the last 12 months an additional 750 people have come on to direct debit payment, and that again it makes it more efficient. We're getting a steady stream of cash coming in. It helps us manage our cash flow. Roughly speaking, if this trend continues, the total value of direct debits per year will be about €90 million. Just then, Section 5 then provides then for the copies of a rate book in electronic form, and we've done that in recent years. It's now available in PDF format. Section 7 and 8 is to do with looking around the collection of interest and how the collection of the rates under the care and the direction of the local authority itself. On Section 10, this is to do with relevant properties and just maintaining database of relevant property. That's something that we do a lot of work on in the City Council, is trying to maintain and keep your rates database up to date, that if there's change of owners, that you're reflecting the change of address. That, you know, when you go to your database, you know it's a correct and accurate reflection of the full information out there in the city. Section 11 is, again, this is just a duty to inform the authority if you transfer properties. And again, that would, again, will help kind of say maybe with the having a more accurate record, a more accurate database information, that when people do move, they would let us know so we have an accurate record of what actually is happening in the city. Section 12 is interest and overdue rates. The department issued this circular towards the end of Q4 of 2024. What will happen is this will be going live in January 2026, and it will apply to arrears from 2025. It had said in case of where there is arrears, the rate will be applied at a daily rate of 0.0219%, which is roughly an annual rate of 8%. It's also said in the regulations that where a ratepayer is in a payment plan where they're paying their current arrears plus addressing their the current debit plus their existing arrears, that there is like discretion at local authority to waive those rates, or waive the interest, excuse me. Section 13 is payment on rated sale of property. And again, this kind of means here that when the property is being sold, that all the rates are going to be paid at that point in time. That kind of gives us improved enforcement and it strengthens compliance. And that means that all the outstanding rates will be paid at the time of the change of liability. Section 14 just provides here that any unpaid rates and any interest accruing is a charge in the property where the owner is the liable person. So just in that the person who is the liable person is responsible for the debts. Section 16 gives us authority there to produce maybe authorised officers, and they will be given a warrant office. We have a warrant office in Dublin City Council, and they then will go around the city inspecting properties for us, maybe confirming if a property is vacant, doing their checks that a property is open for business, that kind of whatever category of business it is. Section 17 is the power of authorised officer to inspect vacant properties. So that's just what it's just a brief overview of the Act. So if there's any questions, please feel free.
Yeah. Thanks, Enda. We have Councillor Pidgeon online.
Thanks very much, and thanks for the presentation. Three points on it. One is I agree with the idea of mixing in this with the statutory budget meeting. I find sometimes when we have the budget meeting on how we're going to spend money separate from how we're going to raise the money, as we do with LBT, sometimes those debates get a little misaligned and people kind of lose a bit of perspective. So I think it's good to kind of have it all bundled into one thing so that people realise the money we raise has a recognition there. I appreciate the slide and the information on the abatement of rates for vacant properties. It was a particular bugbear of mine coming onto the council in the first term, and we succeeded and we got it down to 0%. I would definitely avoid giving any rates abatements to people who own vacant properties. I had just if it's a useful example, I had a man during that debate when the rate went to zero called me up. He was identifying, but he was very, very angry basically because he had vacant properties he couldn't get commercial tenants for and felt it wasn't right that he had to pay rates for. And he said he would have to sell it. And I said to him, like, frankly, that's kind of the point. And he did sell it. And I understand that there is an application there for housing on what was obviously a non-viable commercial unit. So the policy works and it raises money for the city. So I definitely leave it there. My question was, the third point was just around the section on waivers. Is there a possibility, because I know some local authorities do a rebate scheme for, say, small businesses. I think in Dunleary they do a scheme where they pay you back some of the rates. With the waiver, it seems like a neater and more direct way of doing that. Is there a possibility of waivers that are not just geographically set? So does the new legislation allow us to do waivers, for example, that would be sectoral? So just to pull an example out, if we didn't get the tourist tax we were talking about, would it be possible to either directly increase the rates to one particular kind of business or to offer a waiver to all kinds of business except some, if you know what I mean? How flexible is that and what are the grounds for that waiver? Because I think we could do interesting and useful work there in supporting SMEs, but also hitting some other objectives for the city with a more flexible waiver scheme. I know we don't want to create something too complicated, but there could be some good work in that. So that's my question really, is about how we can use waivers. Thanks.
I'm going to take a couple of questions in, if that's okay. Councillor Lacey.
Thanks, Chair. You know, if somebody had gone out of their way to design a complicated system for funding local government, I think even in their wildest imaginations, they couldn't have come up with a system so convoluted that virtually nobody in the country understands. I doubt very much if Graham Doyle, the Secretary General of the Department of Local Government, has a clue on how the system works. And I doubt if Richard Shakespeare has a clue of how the system works in total. It's a bit from here, it's a bit from there. It's a crazy system, more suited to about 200 years ago. It's not your fault, Anna, but it's an absurd system for financing local government. I agree with Councillor Pidgeon about the desirability of linking in both discussions on income and expenditure at the one budget meeting. I think the way it works at the moment allows people to claim all the credits for not raising income and then claim all the credits for spending all the income that they didn't want to raise in the first place. It's a very dishonest system. It doesn't provide for honesty with the public. I think one of the things that we should say in any discussion on rates is, once again, and you think I'm being in a cranky mood today, but just happened to all come up, is to once again point out that government itself decided that it would not pay commercial rates on its own properties. Now, that doesn't affect Town X or Town Y, who have a couple of courthouses and the Department of Social Welfare and another odd building in their town. But the last time we were allowed to calculate it, it cost Dublin City Council, if I remember rightly from Cathy Quinn, 32 million. And that's a further 32 million stolen by central government from the City of Dublin. They still expect us to provide the footpaths, the lampposts, the sewerage, the public amenity areas, and all of the things that other commercial companies that Aidan represents have to pay. But yet it decides it doesn't pay. It pays its photocopying bill. It pays its electricity bill. Why does government think it can get away with not paying its local government bill in the same way? And again, I hate saying this, and I hate being narky. I'm not an narky person by nature, but this is theft from Dublin. And not one single media outlet ever comments on it. They steal local property tax. They steal rates. They steal grant. I saw a grant scheme today, for example, which gives two awards to every single county in Ireland. So Leitrim gets two and Dublin gets two. It's a crazy way. So the two questions I want to ask is, am I right in believing that in recent rates legislation, I don't know if it's this or a previous one, that we are actually forbidden from calculating what rates government would pay if they had to pay? And secondly, do they even pretend in any form of the local government grant scheme, do they even pretend that they give us any of that money back? I mean, they pretend they give us the local property tax back, which they don't. But, I mean, do they even pretend about giving us back the rates, or is it just blatant theft, honest to goodness, straightforward, ordinary, decent criminal-type theft, or is it hidden behind sort of a smokescreen? Thank you.
Thanks.
I'll try and be in better humour for the next meeting.
Oh, no, don't, Dermot, don't. Aidan?
Thank you, Chair. And just to add to Councillor Lacey's point, it was this bill that deleted the public government role from the valuations procedures, not the commercial rates. So it's the mechanism is you always have to go valuations, commercial rates. So that was deleted from the records. It's amazing to think that we were debating this bill 6-7 years ago. And I don't think this chamber actually even made representations at that point on this act. The commercial rates are a frequent bugbear, and I'm conscious of some of the language that's been used around it, but just to say that the gap funding model for local government doesn't work for yourselves, doesn't work for business. In fact, as that is the business, that even when we're talking about the rates waiver schemes, and people are going, well, that's great, we can do a bit here, it's going to fall on business to pick up that slack as well. So in terms of the narrative, in terms of who's actually generating a lot of your revenue, and I think it is closer to 30%. I know you have the 28%, but you take some of the transfers out,
yeah,
it's 30%. To put it in perspective, 24% of businesses in Dublin pay 40-something percent of all the commercial rates nationally. But that money stays within those four local authorities. So we're looked to actually fund a lot of your day-to-day activities. So we're trying to actually have that recognition of it. And I know under Section 15, one of the key things that we pushed for during the legislation was that consultation period. And I think it needs to be with rate payers. What does that mean in terms of the information? I think what you're not also, your presentation is very, very interesting, is getting a certain amount of deja vu in terms of the bill, is to try and say, how are we going to communicate this better to businesses, particularly some of the measures for yourselves? Like that there are some fundamental changes about when the occupier changes, that risk then turns on to the property holder. But they have a short window to inform yourselves of a transfer of the assets. How do we actually day-to-day functionally communicate to ratepayers that happens? There's some good things. On the other hand, like, you know, the annual, the multi-annual, or multi payment instalments and different procedures, because not necessarily in this local authority, but I have other members across the country who are having to go to a window and pay six figures for a commercial rates bill once a year and trying to find someone to actually pay that in. It was just, in the 21st century, that is just crazy. But I think what we need to be saying is that the issue is with your presentation and others, is that gap funding model is a concern on the sustainability of local financing. But the other issue that was missing is then issues like the bid. Different other mechanisms there, that is another way of actually raising additional incomes to fund certain activities within the city council area. And that's one area. The other thing I would say is start looking at businesses on a like-for-like basis and looking at the sustainability of the rate space and the future proofing of it and to understand it. So, for instance, I think what, it's around 22%, I think, of the ratepayers are from the retail sector in Dublin, and they have their initial pressures. In Dunleary Down, it's one out of every three ratepayers are retailers. So it's actually, what is the sustainability as different models are changing? What does that mean? And those are the bigger opportunities, not just looking about rates waivers, is the transfer of commercial premises and vacant commercial property into residential and what that means for the local property tax. Or if there's other mechanisms like the residential zone land tax, is that going to have an impact on our rate space? Even things. So it'd be worthwhile just keeping an eye on those sorts of aspects. And the final point is just trying to say is, are we doing any thought, or do you have any information, for instance, on when the next revaluation process is due to be taken for Dublin City Council? Because I haven't seen anything recently, but we were supposed to have it all going well once every 10 years. To put it into perspective, since when we started the revaluation process back in 2001, Northern Ireland has revalued three times since 2015. So it's actually keeping up to speed with, you know, what market demand is and different elements like that. And I think those are the points that I think we need to have in discussion with commercial rates. Thank you.
Thanks, Aidan. Go back to, I don't think there's any more questions, so I'll go back to Enda.
Thank you. Just going back to Councillor Pidgeon. I do think actually it's better that the process is actually aligned to the statutory budget meeting. It makes it a much smoother process for everyone to capture the full information, that when you make a decision, you see all the impacts together in one place, where sometimes things can be a little bit disjointed on that side. Just on the waiver side, I suppose, it's probably important to bear in mind, I suppose, as well, is that when we look, say, at the moment in terms of our rates collection, our rates debtor is performing very well. We would have been at a high, maybe about, say, €38 million in 2021. And that's come down to 30.7 in 22, down to 28.5, and now down to 27.3 million at year-end 2024, with a collection of 94%. So we're actually, our rates, notwithstanding the issues that are out there, the collection on our rate space is actually performing quite well. We've got a strong team of 13 rate collectors, we've got the rates admin team, and we've got the warrant officers doing quite a good job there, and we've worked very hard over recent years to build up the expertise, to build up the knowledge, and actually to use the new legislation to offer supports to our customers out there to make things as easy as possible for them to pay their rates, because it's a key funding source of the city. We have a lot of challenges on a funding side. We have a lot of challenges on the spending side in the city. So the idea that what rates does is critical to the running of our city. And we use legislation and we use our expertise to make things as effective and as easy as possible for people to work with. On the waiver side, it's important probably to bear in mind that this will be a cost to the city, because at the moment what happens is that at the statutory budget meeting, the elected members adopt the rate evaluation. It's one rate for the city. So what happens is, if you end up giving a waiver to maybe, say, a certain a category of business or an area or things like that, that means that other people in other areas are paying more to help subsidise that. In the case of Dunleary, what they've done is they've worked on, say, on a value amount, you know, that if you pay rates under €3,000, you get 14% back, whatever else. So there's different ways in which it can be worked. But the key thing with the new Section 15 regulations is that the starting off point is that it's supporting the achievement of objectives in your local area community, your plan, your local community plan, your development plans, and it's working through that to see what we can do, and then the cost of that to get an idea as to how you're going to move that going forward, because it will impact on services. That if we are bringing in a waiver scheme, there is a cost to the city, and that detracts scarce resources from somewhere else. Just in terms of Councillor Lacey, just in the recent race, I take on board your point about the statutory budget process, the local government funding and the rates and government properties. Just in the recent race, the last revaluation was in 2014, and at that point the government properties were, when you went into the race, they're now valued at zero. So when Cathy had referenced in the past that it was €32 million, what we did there was we said in 2013 there might have been a payment of €29 million, and then we adjusted that figure over the last 10 years for increases and decreases, and that's how we arrived at the €32 million. I know at the moment the Chief Executive has engaged, we've done work on bringing that back onto the agenda with central government about bringing that back in, because that is, you know, that would be a significant source of funding if that was come directly to the city and could do a huge amount of work for the city. Just in relation to just to Aidan's queries, do them in reverse. The revaluation process, I've meeting scheduled with the Tall Chair and who's the body responsible just before Easter. We met with them in September, and at that point the revaluation had been pushed back to 2028. So I'm just looking for an update on that. It got pushed back with the two COVID years, and then with the burner of the valuation office in the Tall Chair, and there was a priority given in the last, say, 12 to 18 months on actually valuing properties that we had, that the local government, the whole of the country, had submitted for valuation. So that was the main focus in the last, say, 12 to 18 months. But I'll have an update of that for the next SPC. Just then, in terms of the rate base, we are quite conscious that, you know, we have an up-to-date rate base. We employ the rate collectors, the warrant office, going out and identifying businesses and keeping an eye on things that the businesses are now are occupied or new bills come on. And we engage quite proactively with Tall Chair to make sure that we actually have an accurate update valuation of the city, because that means then if we have an accurate valuation, it takes the pressure off us on putting on terms of putting on rates increases. If you have a more accurate rate base, you have more rate payers in your net that you can pay on. So it takes the pressure off the payers that are paying there. I take on board that I look maybe at the issues around, say, the residential and the residential land zone tax. I'm not aware, being honest, if there's any implications, but I will review that and revert back. And then on just in terms then maybe as well, over the last number of years with this Act, we've engaged, kind of say, through our website, through our social media channels, in promoting what actually is happening. And I found that, even maybe just from general budget work, engaging with ratepayers or, say, our customer base, be it the citizens or whatever they are, using social media around, just engaging in different channels of communicating, makes the information more available, more accessible, more understandable. So it's about trying to reach out to people. So I don't have a problem doing that at all. Yeah, I think that would be of benefit. Might be everything, I think.
Okay. Thanks, Enda. Thanks, members. Happy to move on. Yep. Okay. Item six is a report from by Victor just on the role of the Finance SPC. Again, there's a presentation, and then we ask questions and answers after.
This is a sort of extended version, which I think we had at the meeting previously, and this is taken out of the document, which obviously was published to highlight the strategic role of the committees. And I'm not going to go through all the slides. I'm just going to cover only six slides, and it's more from discussion point of view on what you feel is how clear for us is the strategic role. I think there's a quite good discussions were happening about housing rents and how rates, and I think that's what really robust discussion, how we can progress certain issues for collection and maybe raising extra income, and that's very much important as a concept for the strategic policy committees. Close this. Just click next thing. just from definitions point of view, the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage guidelines stating that the main responsibility of the SPC, obviously the finance SPC, is to formation, development, review of policy and strategy. In the later slides, I'll try to sort of expand on that and to see what specific responsibility. It's really try to consider any statutory plans, corporate policies, and incorporate into work programs of the SPCs. Climate action is fundamental. That obviously anything what we're doing, we need to be seeing how this is going to affect. And then it's a substantial cross-cutting issue for all work programs. As well, the regional assembly and what is happening is in within the relevant area, and linked to corporate policy group. And this idea, my understanding is that the chair would be reporting back to the corporate policy group in relation to our program of works and what we will be doing. And there is a link back that at some stage, maybe in the middle of the term, we have to look into see if how we're doing it, how there's any changes. Just on the more specific roles is this principle of advise and assist the council of its work. It's a finance SPC, it's a subcommittee, and anything here what we could be doing is to really try to talk and discuss areas and formulating at early stages of the policy. Obviously from that, moving into the wider council for adoption, and it's a very useful tool for building consensus and building obviously a base for something which then could be approved by the main council. It's an opportunity it's a full involvement on the policy making process at early stages. Principles, preliminary background work discussions and recommendations discussed here before that go into the council meeting, and principles of bringing councillors, sector representative, chief executive, assistant chief executive, and staff from the council, and potentially including other groups as a other interest, and invitations of other interest into this discussion is part of the strategic role, and work between SPC chair and the responsible assistant chief executive. The work program, and we spent some time previously developing the work program, and then you see this is what we have currently. There's no restrictions for us to add things, and maybe some things maybe change the priorities. Very important is that this links to a corporate plan, how it's affected, whatever we're doing through the corporate plan, because it's a joint document, obviously, from executive point of view and the councillors. And then, as I said previously, linked to the corporate policy group, and at some stage, at third year of the term, try to look at and see if anything needs to be changed and reviewed. The strategic role, and you will be familiar with some of the lines in there. This is very specific to ourselves, because this is what we have in our terms of references, and concept of the strategic statutory nature, and really what we'll be talking about there is of how we can achieve transparency, accountability in expenditure and resourcing, and really thinking about that, what can we do in this finance SPC to achieve that. Collection of debts, as we had previous presentations, two presentations, that's all over the world, and then it's significant interest in relation to the debt and how we can improve on that. All principles of value for money and security of quality of the services. How can we be sustained in some terms? How do we achieve to make sure that we have an efficient use of the limited resources? Promoting social and economic prosperity and equality, obviously taking those items into consideration, and all this area of sustainable local government funding. And the idea of getting extra income and try to be innovative about where the income will be converted and go maybe after some income sources which previously we had on a zero basis, we say government rates, or potentially expanding into areas as a hotel tax. And it's very much important that this is discussed before we move to the main council. Over area of governance and community and development. The policy areas of finance SPC, and this is just a reminder of the main items, but as you can see, there's all normal things in relation to how we formulate capital and revenue budget, overall area of local authority funding. There's other areas of like risk management, very important, is that it's presented and discussed, obviously, with yourselves. Whole area of borrowings to maintain our asset base, potentially, and how we're going to pay for that. That's very much important. And all that principle of how local property tax is allocated to the Dublin's council. Sorry, just I think. The other consideration which needs to be taken into, obviously, in this strategic approach, how we develop a work program is, well, consideration to the disability, needs of people with a disability, and how anything what we do, and how we formulate policy affecting those groups, and principle of sustainability principles in particular services, and all that area of strategic monitoring local authority services. And that's really accountability piece for the board, for executive to respond to, and obviously this group and then the wider council to monitor. I think that's really for me. The rest of the slides is pretty much outlining what is the responsibility of the chief executive, how certain proposals needs to be made to SPC and how discussed. This is a recap of a document, of a sort of guidance how we should be operating. I'm just prepared to take any questions if anybody wants to.
Right, thanks very much, Victor. Is there any questions on that? If not today, members, particularly some of the new members, if you want to read through that full presentation and ask, if you have any questions come for either Victor or myself, just please pass them on, because I know there is a lot of information to take in, but it's there for people to read back on. Okay, thanks for that, Victor. We'll move on. The next item, again, it's a presentation for Victor, this time item 7. It's a presentation on the programme for government 2025.
Okay, that's really my interpretation of what I think relevant, and it's to try to open up discussion. When I was asked by the SPC to see how would the program for government affecting us, this is an attempt to see where could it affect purely finance SPC and where it's going to affect maybe elected members and representatives. And as well to see what's happening from the central government point of view on in relation to the Dublin and development of the Dublin. And what really this program is talking about is, which I think relevant to this group, how public services are delivered and improvement on investment, culture and productivity, and how any investment in the modern technology and digitalization improve the services. This is a focus for us. And from some of the items on our work program, we'll be talking about the cyber security issues. We will be talking about how really our investment is implemented, and that will support that activity. As well, an interesting item is in there is that we could be sort of dipping into is that the Irish Government Economic and Valuation Services would be something there for review and could be submitted to yourselves for interest as a point. At later stage, we have some, I think it's more for noting, NOAC reports and what reports need to do. But there's other groups and other research groups will be potentially doing some work associated with the local government. All this area of public procurement process and how transparent are we, and this concept of how we can get small to medium enterprises get more involved in procuring for service. There is a quite substantial resource of procurable spend within Dublin City Council. We could be talking about close to €1 billion, which could be available for the wider groups, and how to make them really be able to apply and compete. The obviously area of report capital of capital spending is quite fundamental. We have a quite robust mechanism of reporting on through our capital budget and through our sector, but it's a matter of what else can we do to help obviously this group and electric members to achieve greater transparency and overall oversight of the expenditure. And I thought that interestingly is that this idea of where we spend our money, where your money goes, principle is an area could be where we can reflect how our budgets are spent, how what we're actually doing. And by looking into the program, there was a specific reference to the Dublin City Centre Task Force, obviously. Councillor Lacey mentioned that. It'll be interesting to see how it's going to develop, because there is a great ambition, but we have to see where the money will come from and how it's going to be implemented. Important that Dublin is recognised as a vibrant and safe, obviously our strategy to become an important destination is in there, and it's obviously great to see. And I think part of this SPC is to see how we can monitor progress of that program. Other areas, just to show it here, is the strengthening of local democracy. And it mainly what we have here is this how executive could assist elected members in more transparency, try to see if we can have more clarity in the local authority budget delivery. And I think that's what for this SPC is quite important, that we can have an extra scrutiny here before it goes to the main council. And areas of what is alignment between resource function and executive functions in there. Obviously, overall acknowledgement how much work local government is doing for the democracy and a level of services which we're delivering to the community. The other areas in the strengthening local democracy, idea of accountability of the chief executive and all the executive, enhancing fiscal autonomy and role of the national oversight and audit of the commission has been specifically mentioned. As well, principle of how the management could be held to the account. And it's really all talking about is that more transparency, more accountability from the executive and the local authorities. I think that's really all. The document is quite extensive, and if I missed anything, obviously we can bring to it. But that's just obviously to open up a conversation in response to requests. Just
thanks so much for that, Victor. Any questions on that? No. Okay. Is that document agreed?
Well, what are we agreeing, Chair?
Well, noted. Sorry.
I mean, the document would make my sort of heart go weep when you read things like, you know, the government recognises that local government is beating heart of our democracy. They don't believe a word of it. Now they think, I mean, if you just think about it, since last December, they've taken away powers on planning. They've abolished the Joint Policing Committee. They've changed the regulations on traffic. And they claim that local government is beating heart of democracy. I mean, there's only one word, and I really hate saying this. It's only one. They are total, utter, and complete hypocrites. This document, I'm talking about the government's document, not Victor's document. The government's document doesn't have a scintilla of honesty, commitment, integrity, or sincerity about it. The department will continue to do what they've done for the last 40 years, and that is deliberately, systematically try to destroy our local government system. That is the agenda of the department, aided and abetted by weak ministers, and they'll continue to do that. I desperately hope I'm wrong. I really do. I would love to come back into this chamber in 12 months' time and say, God, Seamus, I was wrong, and the government really were committed. But, 32 years in this council has taught me to be a little bit cynical, which I regret. Thank you.
Thanks, Seamus. We'll note the document, so. And no one else indicate.
Can I say something there? Can I come in there?
Sorry, yeah, Councillor Sutcliffe, go ahead, yeah.
I want to back Councillor Lacey in all the words and even go further. They're taking us as local councillors for granted, and they've been taking us for granted. And I'm only a new member there, but I've never really disagreed with Councillor Lacey's opinions, and that's one of the opinions that I want to back up very, very strongly.
Okay, thanks, Councillor.
Okay.
Okay, the next item is item 8, is the annual work programme for the Finance SPC. This is just a standing item on the agenda, just to keep a note of what we're doing. So unless there's any specific questions, I'm just going to leave that on the agenda for every meeting, so just so we can just keep an eye on what our work plan is, just to make sure what we're doing is what we agreed to do. So is that noted? Okay, item 9 is the reports of the National Oversight and Audit Committee. There was a request to circulate these. Is there any specific questions on those reports? No. Okay, they're noted. Item 10, Aingen Oella, any other business?
Can I just say one thing, Chair? Because I have been critical, and I am critical, and I really reject the way in which the Irish state operates local government. But just to be clear, I do so because I believe in local government, because I believe that we could transform this country through a reformed local government system. So while I'm cynical about government, of all parties, including my own, on this issue, I am not cynical at all about the possibilities of local government. Local government in the past in this country, if you just take one example, housing. Up into the mid-1980s, when local government had responsibility for housing, by and large, you could get accommodated in the city. It is since the state took over, the national took over, the department took over, that the housing crisis has grown. So I retain my enthusiasm for local government, even if I'm critical of the mother department that's meant to look after us and doesn't. Thank you.
Thanks, Dermot. Aidan?
Thank you, Chair. Just two things just to worth to be noted that maybe we might consider for addition to the work programme in the future is that the government is currently working on its new national, our first national procurement strategy, as well as the e-procurement rules are being up, the review of them are currently underway. So if there are specific asks from the local government sector, particularly with Dublin City Council, you know, I think it's something that we should be thinking about, you know, putting forward recommendations as well into those processes. And likewise, it wasn't picked up because it wasn't Dublin only in the programme for government analysis, is will we be making a submission to the NDP review, which is due by mid-July? I know this SPC in the past, had input into the recovery and resilience plan submissions and different things. This look at our capital programs. Are there specific asks we should be advocating for in terms of actually large capital expenditure, whether individual projects or programs that could benefit the city? I think we should be maybe considering that at our next meeting. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. We can definitely look at those two items. Thanks, Aidan. Any other business? Okay, next meeting is Thursday the 15th of May at 2:30. Thanks, members.